This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. How do you think Vermont's economy is doing? You probably listen to the news and hear that our unemployment rate is low, quite low, in fact, 3.6% in the latest numbers. That's under the national average of just over 5%, and the general rule of thumb is that a 5% unemployment rate, or lower, represents full employment. But the unemployment figure is just one indicator of how our economy is doing, and it may not reflect what people are experiencing. If you're employed but making the same or maybe even less than you did in 2008, for example, you're not going to be feeling sanguine about the economy. Ditto if your home value went down and you're trying to ride it out until you're above water again. And if you're a shop owner on Main Street, you have a sense of what people are actually buying and how they're feeling about their stability and future earnings. So how do we get these individual reports and anecdotes to jive with statistics? Well, for one thing, there are a lot of different statistics we can look at to try to shape a fuller picture of Vermont's economic future. And that's what we're going to try to do today. We're joined by Art Wolf. He's a professor of economics at UVM, and he was the state economist under former Governor Madeline Cunin. Art, nice to talk with you again.
Good to be here.
And John Erickson is a fellow at the Gund Institute for Ecological Economics at UVM, where he co-leads the Vermont GPI. Or general progress indicator. He's with us as well. Hi, John. Nice to talk with you.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
All right. So first thing I'd like you to do, I mentioned a couple of things that we can use to look at the economy and to get a sense that jobs picture is one, unemployment figures. Just tick off a few that you look at and you think are valuable in trying to get this picture of how our state's economy is. John?
Sure. The traditional way of looking at economic health or economic well-being has been a gross state product. So the size of the economy, how big the economy is, all those goods and services bought by households, bought by government, bought by businesses. And according to that statistic, the economy has recovered from the Great Recession. Gross state product per person had peaked in 2006 and was fully recovered by 2010. But there's a lot of other indicators that people are scratching their heads saying, well, it may have recovered for some, but not all. And so we also look at income inequality. We also look at the benefits and costs of that recovery. As you know, the state has recently adopted a different, more holistic, broader way of accounting for the quality of that growth called the Genuine Progress Indicator. And that includes a long list of adjustments that are made to gross state product. Economic adjustments like inequality, environmental adjustments like the cost of pollution or the cost of natural resource depletion, also social adjustments. One of the big things that we don't often account for is the cost of our time. And when we work more, a lot of the economic indicators tick up. But, it might come at the sacrifice of our time in our communities, our time with our families, our time for leisure. And so,
plus if you're working more hours and making the same money, that's a lower hourly wage.
Some metrics like median household income we've seen have been quite flat over the last few decades. Average real wages have been flat since really just before the Great Recession. And so, not only is the amount we're getting for our work flat or in some cases in decline, if you look at minimum wage and you adjust it for inflation, it's been going down over quite a long time.
Art Wolf, what about for you? What else do you look at?
Well, first, I disagree with a lot of what John just said. But in terms of the numbers that I look at, first of all, you're kind of stuck. You can only look at numbers that exist. And so the numbers that exist are few and far between in terms of a monthly basis to give us a snapshot. We look at the unemployment rate, look at the number of jobs in the state, how many people are looking for work. So those are kind of the only numbers we have on a monthly basis. On an annual basis, we can look at things like income, which I think is extremely important. And we have some numbers on that. Basically, what we try to do with all the numbers we look at is try to figure out what's the standard of living doing? How are we doing now compared to last month or last year? So the ones that I focus on are the monthly numbers that we get from the Vermont Department of Labor, and then the annual numbers we get from the Census Bureau on a variety of issues, including incomes.
All right. Art, you said you disagree with John on a lot of things, and I want to get into that later because one of the things that I think is confusing for me and perhaps for other people is how the heck do you get a real sense of what's going on when politicians use numbers depending on what they want to highlight. And even economists use different numbers to gauge how they think the economy is doing. And so I definitely want to get into that. And listeners, I want to also invite you into the conversation, because we're talking about statistics, we're talking about numbers, but of course, how you feel is your indicator. And so we'd love to know how you see things, your savings account. What else, though? Do you look at the shops in your town and see that they're open? Have you seen a lot of fluctuation? Are you feeling like you have a lot of faith in your income, your job, your future? Do you feel like low unemployment numbers reflect an optimism that you feel in the state, or do they mask some real struggles of Vermonters? Our number, if you'd like to weigh in, is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Okay, so before we get into that question of how do you even figure out if you're a regular person reading reports or just trying to gauge how your feelings jive with what the rest of the economy is doing, let's talk a little bit about all of those things that you both just mentioned. And are they telling one story? Are they telling the same story, do you think, about Vermont's economic picture? And what is that? Art, we'll go back to you first.
Sure. Well, what they're telling us is that things are getting better. Unfortunately, they're getting better slowly. Now, they're not getting worse, which they did in the Great Recession and immediately after that. The things were terrible then. But our economy is growing, growing more slowly than we would like, more slowly than it has in the past. And I think that's the source of a lot of people's frustrations, is that, okay, you're telling us, they're telling economists, you're telling us that things are getting better, but boy, it sure doesn't feel like I'm doing a lot better than I was in the past. And certainly, kind of looking back over your lifetime, 20 years or so, things felt better when I was younger than they are now. And the U.S. economy is going through a very wrenching period of structural adjustment, and Vermont's going through an even more wrenching period for a variety of reasons.
When you say things are getting better, do you mean getting better from 2008 when the bottom fell out? Or so if, for example, you're somebody who in 2008 you found you were underwater in your home and you lost your job, things may be getting better now, but are they looking better from 2005, say?
Well, I think that, yes, things are better than they were in 2005. My measure of median family income is higher. Our unemployment rate, compared to 2005, it's about the same as 2005. The number of jobs in the state is higher than it was in 2005. So there's a lot of indicators that are above that.
John Erickson, what do you think?
Well, yeah, I agree that things are growing. The question is, you know, who benefits from that growth and who bears the cost, both current and future generations. A lot of the indicators, absolutely on a monthly basis, make us think in monthly terms or in quarterly terms, or and maximizing some sort of metric of growth or benefit over the short term. If you take a longer view, absolutely, Vermonters all per capita have three times as much stuff that we had in the 1960s. So three times as much household consumption, business investment, government expenditure. When you add all that up, we have three times as much stuff per person. But it's important to sort of ask.
So stuff, you're not talking about, you know, cars and toys.
I'm talking about cars and toys and everything that is captured in the formal marketplace. But that.
Yay, right?
Yay, yeah. So we spend a lot of money, and we spend a lot of money on things that have certainly increased what you might call our material well-being. Those averages are going up. Those aggregates are going up. But, you know, even the economists who created things like gross state product, gross national product, were very careful to say what that measures and what it doesn't. So if you take, for example, Simon Kuznets, Nobel-winning prize economist, one of the crafters, the creators of what we call our gross national product, I brought a quote along from him. He said in 1962, quote, distinctions must be kept in mind between quantity and quality of growth, between its cost and return, between the short and the long term. Goals for more growth should specify more growth of what and for what, and I might add for whom.
So do you think then overall that we're not doing better even though we have more stuff?
Better is a relative thing, right? So better, if you're asking, do we have more stuff per person? Absolutely. In a planet that's filling up with our presence, does more have higher and higher costs to gaining more as we develop our land, as we pollute our rivers, as we pump out greenhouse gas emissions into our atmosphere. These are all things that are costs, consequences of the current growth model that aren't accounted for in traditional metrics, and they're really hard to get at. It's easy to count up all those market transactions because we measure that, and we measure those really, really well. It's not so hard. It's much harder to measure all of those informal, non-market interactions.
But that's what you're trying to do, right, with the GPI, the Genuine Progress
Indicator. Yeah, that's the mandate from the state, is to account for a more holistic measure of well-being. The Genuine Progress Indicator is something that has been developed over 3 decades as a tool that comes from standard economics, that uses standard economic practices for valuation of non-market costs.
Is that because people say that what you're doing is not actually looking at statistics and indicators? It sounds like a defense of the GPI that you're using, you know, the standard way that economists look at the economy. Or is there some concern that maybe you wouldn't be?
No, I don't think so. I think it, you know, GPI, its greatest strength is that it's in dollars, so it can be compared to something like GDP. Its greatest weakness is that it's in dollars. And, you know, a lot of the well-being statistics are trying to move beyond just simply dollars and cents to measure how we're doing.
So, Art Wolf, what do you think then? I mean, it sounds like you said you disagree with a lot of what John is saying, but both of you say you're using numbers, and I don't dispute that numbers can be skewed to represent what you want them to be, but how can you disagree with numbers?
Well, the problem is I think every economist realizes that GDP is not the be-all and end-all. Nobody wants to die, and on their tombstone it says he did as much as he could to increase GDP. There's a lot more to life than that. The question is trying to measure and put some sort of metric on that. So, for example, I think clean air and clean water are good too, but I can't really easily put a dollar figure on that and tell you what that's worth, just like I can't put a dollar figure on how much is it worth the fact that we live maybe 3 or 4 years longer than we did in the 1960s. How much is that worth? I mean, economists do put dollar figures on that, but you can't really include that in GDP because it's just really hard to do. Every economist recognizes that GDP has limitations, and I don't think it's the goal of state policy or anybody else to maximize GDP. What we want to do is we want to maximize quality jobs. We want to maximize people's income, their standard of living, and their opportunities. And that's really what I think is the most important thing that we should focus on.
Well, and you did focus recently in an essay that you wrote for the Free Press about what jobs we're seeing actual growth in the state of Vermont. So what are we seeing growth in, and are those jobs that then equate to higher incomes for Vermonters?
Yeah, over the last, I think I looked at the last 10 and 20 years, yeah, we're seeing jobs and big job growth in – well, we should say we're not seeing much job growth overall. The numbers are very small, but within that lack of growth, and that's due to our demographics, we're seeing declines in certain areas like in manufacturing. So we're actually using fewer people to produce the stuff, if you want to use John's term. We're a lot more people working in healthcare, a lot more people working in professional and business services, and those are both pretty high-paying job sectors. So we are seeing growth in those sectors. And a lot of people claim that retail doesn't pay a lot, and that may be true, but a lot of people want part-time jobs that don't necessarily have all work all week. Retail has actually been pretty flat for the last 10 or 15 years. So we're not getting those kind of what people claim are low-paying job growth. We seem to be getting a lot in some of the high-paying sectors. Now, we're losing a lot in manufacturing, which is also high-paying, but we're only losing those jobs primarily because of rapid productivity growth. Businesses in the manufacturing sector are able to produce as much or actually more than they did in the past with fewer people.
Well, and you point out, for what it's worth, Vermont's state government jobs have been continuing to grow through the recession and on past it, which is not the case for most states in the country.
That's right. State and local government jobs. Yeah. In the recession, there was a huge decline nationally in state and local government jobs. In Vermont, it was flat. And in the last few years, we've been growing not rapidly, but we've been growing. And nationally, there's fewer people working for state and local governments today than there were in 2007. In Vermont, there's more, even though there's not any more people in Vermont. And the population of the U.S. is greater. So we're moving in a divergent trend from the nation.
John Erickson, I'd love to know what you're seeing in terms of, I guess, what we could call the prosperity gap. Are you seeing that widen, that Vermonters who are at the low end of the spectrum are staying there and the richer Vermonters are getting richer? Or are we seeing those numbers, those two sort of ends coming together a little bit more?
Yeah, it is very much matching national trends. So Vermont for a long, long, long time was one of those states that had a very equal income distribution. Pre-Great Recession, we were fifth in the nation in terms of income inequality as measured by the Gini coefficient. Post-Great Recession, we're now 14th in the nation. And in fact, that's only Montana changed more than we did. So it's moving in a direction that suggests, again, much like the rest of the country, that income is being generated, growth is occurring, but we've heard the narrative nationally that the growth is being concentrated in the hands of fewer and fewer folks.
Well, listeners, I'd like to hear what you think about that, particularly if you think of yourself as somebody who's in the middle class. How do you define that, and what are you seeing from your perspective? Maybe, you're just sort of trying to sit tight and not feeling really negative or really positive. Whatever your perspective, let us know. Jesse and Nancy are waiting on the line. We're going to come to you in just a moment. We're talking about economic indicators and what they tell us about Vermont's economy, how we use them, and what you're thinking. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking with UVM economics professor Art Wolf and also from UVM, Gund Institute for Ecological Economics fellow John Erickson, about how we use a multitude of statistics and anecdotes to try to get a feel for the Vermont economy. What we really want to hear is how you gauge progress and economic vitality. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Ben says, I own a small electrical contracting business in Shaftesbury. Before the Great Recession, I used to get 5 or 6 phone calls a day for service. That dropped down to about 5 or 6 calls a week. The fourth quarter is always busy historically, and I'm coming home now to about 2 calls a day. Let's go to Nancy calling in from South Burlington. Hi, Nancy. Your thoughts?
Hi. Thanks for putting me on. As I was listening to the indicators for the economic stability, I was thinking about my own family situation where, yes, our income is the same or better than it has been in the past. And yes, we have 2 people who are employed, but our family is split because my husband cannot find gainful employment as professional in the state of Vermont. So he had to go out of state and now need to continue to do so to maintain our ability to spend. And so I think sometimes the statistics are deceiving and don't kind of reveal the realities of the families who aren't able to stay gainfully employed in professional ways in the state of Vermont.
Nancy, thanks for your perspective. Let's get a couple more in here, and then we can come back to Art and John. Jesse's on the line with us from Montpelier. Hi, Jesse. Go right ahead.
Hi, Jane. I just wanted to call because I wanted to respond to the economic situation that I see. And I find it extremely hard being a sole proprietor in that when it comes tax time, we are taxed so heavily. And it seems like $25 an hour for a painter is good until that time of year comes around, and then you really feel it hard.
Yeah.
So I guess I could, I just want to say one more thing about the hourly rate there. I've worked for big paint companies before, and they'll charge $40, $42 an hour for me. But I find that if I ever try to, say to somebody that that's my hourly rate, there's just so much other competition that that's just, like, totally unreasonable. So these big companies are getting, like, huge tax breaks and somehow can afford to, like, pay their employees, $25 an hour, but charge them out for way more than I could ever, do myself.
Yeah, Jesse, I hear you. And thanks for your comments and thanks for your personal perspective there. It's interesting to hear people talking about what they're feeling. We also got a note from Sarita who says, economic growth is difficult with the current banking structure, wherein unless you want mega bucks, you can't get financing in the $75,000 to $150,000 range. Banks are totally risk averse for the small entrepreneur. And Christy says, I think we're floundering due to unimaginative business as usual practices by the Shumlin administration. They keep telling us that we're building new green jobs, but what they mean is they have new but temporary green jobs in Chittenden County while the rest of the state gets shuffled into service positions. We need a new approach and we need more smaller businesses. You know, whenever we do these shows, it's rare to get, you know, a list of people calling in or writing in saying, I'm doing great, and the economy is doing great, and the state is doing great. So, Art, what do you think? I mean, you've said the state is doing pretty well. Do people – is it just human nature to not feel positive, or is there some disconnect between what the numbers are saying and what people are actually feeling?
Well, I think there's a little bit of all that. First of all, people always want more. They would like to have a little bit more than they had before. We probably could have been sitting here 25 years ago and having the same conversation, and yet today we are. I don't think anybody would disagree that we're better off than we were 25 years ago. So I think people just want more, and when they find their incomes and their standard of living not growing as fast as they'd like, they get depressed and upset. But some of the calls, I think.
Let me push you on that a little bit, because you know. When we've done these shows in the past, and when you look at news reports, you often hear that, say, my parents' generation, my parents were buying their first house in the mid-70s. And they, on you know pretty mid-level incomes, could afford to buy a new house. They didn't have to get the down payment money from their parents. They could have one car, then two if they needed it. And they didn't, you know, they were able to save some. That seems much harder for my generation, which is delaying marriage, delaying having kids, delaying buying houses if they're able to buy houses at all. Partly because of, you know, choices that they're making, but also partly because of what they see as an inability to access those things that were formerly seen as just part of the American way of life. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, is it really true that people would be saying 25 years ago, I'm not better off than they are now, and in actual fact we're doing just as well?
Well, a couple of things. When I worked for Governor Cunin back in the late 1980s, people were complaining about housing unaffordability and nobody could afford to buy a house anymore, and so it's, things stay the same. But in terms of the ability to buy a new house, yeah, my parents back in the 1950s bought new houses. They bought a couple of them over the course of the 50s and 60s. And we don't see young people doing that anymore. And part of that is I think, because of our own policies. We made housing very expensive. But you also have to remember that a house today is not the same as a house was in 1975 or 1955. It's a lot bigger. It's got a lot more amenities. It's got more bathrooms, more bedrooms, more square footage, a two-car garage. You know, I can go down the list, but it's unfair to say that our expectations have grown. If you wanted to buy the same house your parents bought as a new house in 1975, it'd be a lot cheaper today. The land would be expensive, and that's the regulatory issue, I think. But our expectations have grown, and that's kind of what we mean by the standard of living. We always want more, and we just kind of expect that, well, gee, my house is going to be at least as nice as the house I grew up in, and if not better, I deserve it. So there's that. But the other thing I wanted to say about some of the comments of people is even though we're talking about aggregate statistics, you know, that's the state as a whole, but there are parts of the state that are doing a lot better. The greater Chittenden County area, kind of going all the way up to St. Albans, maybe down to Vergennes, out to Waterbury, that's really where all the action is in the state. The rest of the state is doing a lot worse than that. So depending on where you are, you can have very different expectations and very different opportunities.
John Erickson, weigh in here on
sure.
It's the part that most interests you, because we just covered a lot of territory.
I'll respond to Nancy's point. I think it's a good one. And reflecting on her own experiences with her own family, needing two incomes, needing to have one of those jobs out of the state, to keep up with that kind of material standard of living, to keep up with the debt payments, to keep up with filling in the holes here and there, you know, these kinds of choices are presenting new costs, you know. So for a long time, you know, we've developed as a society, and here in Vermont, no exception, for example, by commuting longer and longer and longer to work. That should be recognized as a cost. You know, if people, especially in surveys, say, I don't really enjoy my commute to work, I enjoy part of it, but not all of it.
But isn't it recognized as a cost? I mean, certainly in how much you're paying for gas.
It's if you count all of that, what's spent on that as a benefit, which it is in our traditional income accounts, our GDP accounts, that's recognized as a benefit when you equate that with welfare, when you equate that with well-being. For a long time, we've seen less and less leisure. We've seen less and less time with family. We've seen less and less time in community. And Vermont's not immune to these kinds of changes that we're seeing in kind of the pursuit of the American dream to kind of maintain that level of standard of living that Art is referring to, but maintain it at what cost? And I think that's this key transition moment that Americans are in the middle of, and Vermont is not excluded. I would take issue with the sentiment that people want more. Social science research shows that, yes, people want more, but up to a point. And when they get to that certain level of well-being, when they get to the point where they're covering all of their basic needs, the question of more always comes as we say in economics, at an opportunity cost. And if you're going to get more by sacrificing time with your family or community or leisure, is it worth that trade-off? And I think that's the struggle that everyday Americans are having, you know, more at what cost? How much is enough? You know, is in the kind of common debate that we're having in this country nationwide, you know, what is enough?
If I'm remembering correctly, and you may have more accurate figures on this, but my memory is that some studies were done that showed that people want more and are happier the more money they make, up to, I think it was $75,000-ish. And I don't know if that needs to be adjusted for inflation. But then beyond that, they're not happier. But, it still strikes me that people do still want more money.
It's tough because we get into these kinds of arms races, right, with keeping up with the Joneses. Poverty, income, well-being, it's all relative. So it's relative to my peer group. So if you see your peer group continuing to increase, and if your peer group is, you know, Britney Spears and Brianna and these kinds of folks, then you do feel like you're deprived, right? But you know, the planet, our societies, our cultures can only give so much. And so part of this debate is, do we have to really start rethinking our expectations? Do our expectations need to change to match economic, social, and indeed environmental reality?
We have a couple more comments I want to read. Scott says, I'm concerned to see that as the price of gas and other fuels has dropped, we've not seen a decrease in other prices like food in the supermarkets. We were always told when the price of gas went up dramatically nearly a decade ago that so many other prices were going up due to the increased cost of transportation and production, which rely on gas and oil. Adam says, my wife and I are both 29 and made the decision to move back to Vermont this past June. We left good-paying jobs in Massachusetts to get out of the rat race and back to the Vermont lifestyle, but I believe we were a little overconfident in our ability to find good-paying jobs. My wife is currently working 2 part-time jobs while I continue to look for a full-time position. Although I have found positions, taking a pay cut from $45,000 to $25,000 a year is not something I'm willing to do yet. I'm still hopeful that with some time we'll find what we're looking for. In the meantime, we can enjoy the beauty of Vermont in the fall. And Carl says, in a finite system such as the Earth, forever sustainable growth is a mathematical oxymoron. With the understanding that forever growth is impossible, it becomes apparent that growth must at some point stop. The remaining question is when and how. Just a few minutes left here in this discussion, and I'm curious from both of your perspectives how you would suggest that people who are, you know, monitoring their own feelings, talking to their friends and neighbors, checking out how things are going in their own town, and then listening to news reports and listening to politicians and listening to this conversation we're having where, you know, there can be differing perspectives and different numbers being brought in. What do you advise people to do to try to get a better gauge on what's actually happening that is more than just the unemployment report, which, as we know, does not cover necessarily how many people want jobs or if they're in jobs that they like? Art?
Well, first of all, I would not listen to politicians because they're – primary goal or their sole goal is to get elected, and they'll
say,
"Sure,
but we got to vote for them." You know, you come in and you got to vote for somebody. You got to listen to something they're saying.
Unfortunately, that's the system. So the answer is have them do as little as possible rather than as much as possible. Because I would say think about your own personal situation. Be sure your own living situation is sustainable. Don't live beyond your means. What kind of opportunities are there in your own business? In your own personal lives, and maximize those.
And just don't worry about the rest of it?
Well, I mean, you should look at the big picture and see what's going on, because if the economy's collapsing around you, but your company's doing okay, I would still be concerned. But yeah, look around you. But I would focus on, you know, your neighbors, your friends, your own job situation, your own personal situation. Boost your skills, make yourself as employable as possible, make good financial decisions, all those kind of things.
John Erickson?
Yeah, I mean, Americans are good at redefining progress. We do it all the time. You know, decade to decade, generation to generation, we reset the dial of what we think is the good life, what we think is progress. And I taught my first class this morning for the fall semester, and I can tell you that my students at UVM are aspiring to a new kind of standard of living, a new kind of progress that isn't so dependent on debt and material standards of living, but is maybe more dependent on time and community and family. I know that's all kind of a big, rosy, hopeful picture, but I think the American dream is changing. I think this election and the kinds of leadership that we're looking for is reflective of those kinds of changes. I think you're getting a lot of populist talk around economic reform that basically boils down to redefining progress.
That's John Erickson. He's a fellow at the Gund Institute for Ecological Economics at UVM, where he works on the Vermont GPI, the Genuine Progress Indicator. Art Wolf is a professor of economics at UVM and editor of the Vermont Economy Newsletter. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jane.
Coming up, we travel into the fictional world of Three Pines, the creation of novelist Louise Penny. She's been revealing the real-world inspirations for some of the best-known settings in her Inspector Gamache mystery series. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The latest Inspector Gamache book is out from Canadian novelist Louise Penny. The protagonist in her international bestsellers is the former head of homicide for Montreal's Sûreté, the provincial police. In the latest book, Armand Gamache has retired to the little village of Three Pines, but of course, he's drawn back to the dark underbelly of humanity when a child in the village turns up dead. Despite all the murders, Three Pines is the kind of place that you'd want to live. A warm, welcoming village in the eastern townships, just north of the Vermont border. There's Sarah's Boulangerie, where you can get a loaf of crusty bread, and Olivier's Bistro, where people watching is as delectable as the food. And then there's Myrna's Bookstore. You go there when you need not just a book, but a good listener and some thoughtful conversation. Penny, the creator of this fictional village, has been revealing the inspirations for some of the memorable settings in her books. So earlier this month, I caught up with her at Brome Lake Books in Knowlton, Quebec. She was highlighting the bookstore as the inspiration for Myrna's bookstore, and she was officially launching her newest title, The Nature of the Beast. So many people wanted to say hello that I had to sneak out to the bookstore's back porch with Penny and with bookstore owners Danny McCauley and Lucy Hoblin to have a chat about why Brome Lake Books is so special.
It's like the bookstore from the novels. It's the wooden shelves, and it's warm and welcoming, and you just want to sit down. There's a little sitting area. This place feels like a magical place, and particularly with Danny and Lucy, who have become good friends.
And was it really in your mind as you wrote about Myrna's bookstore?
Not really. I mean, it was partly in terms of the feel of it, absolutely. What's really cool that Danny and Lucy have done is that they've actually created a little, I don't know if you've seen it, but it's a little area inside with a fireplace and a couple of chairs, because I love writing those scenes in the books with Gamache normally sitting there with Myrna. And talking about philosophy, or talking about her take on things, or just opening up to her, or Clara and Myrna talking. And so they've got the two big comfortable chairs and the fireplace. And Danny and Lucy have recreated that here. And there's even a plaque that says Myrna's Bookstore, isn't there?
Yes. Welcome to Three Pines. That's what it is.
Yeah. Well, Danny and Lucy, for you guys, you know, I walked in, of course, if you're a fan of the Gamache series and you know Myrna's Bookstore, you're picturing a large, very welcoming, very kind, but also very sharp woman named Myrna who would run it. But you really expect to see a duck named Rosa and a caustic old woman named Ruth, and I didn't see any of those three characters in here, just you two.
Sorry to disappoint. We'll work on that now.
Rosa is actually there. She's beside the wood-burning stove.
Aha, I'm going to have to go check.
Yeah, we have a little electric wood-burning stove, but standing beside it, we had to have a Rosa. So, and the caustic old woman, she sometimes comes into the store, but she wasn't into here today.
It must be lovely to be recognized as a, you know, sort of a part of this series, but also you are certainly, and of course, an entity in and of yourselves. And as an independent bookseller, does having a connection to somebody like Louise, who is a champion for bookstores, but also has this series that evokes so many warm thoughts in people, feel good to you?
Oh, we love it. We love being part of this. It's so exciting. And the fans are the most exciting part. I mean, we have people in today, but people in all the time, all summer long, they're coming in. You can just tell they're coming in, looking around, going, this is the bookstore, this is the place. And they're coming from the U.S., they're coming from Tasmania, they're coming from Ireland, they're coming from all over the world. And they're looking for Three Pines. And they find us. Although I had some people in today going, you are the hardest bookstore to find. I go, well, it's like Three Pines. If you're meant to find us, you find us. But we love meeting them. They're the best fans. Absolutely. They're the sweetest people, the most excited people. And they love talking about books and all the characters. And they just love the series.
Lucy, for you, does having people come in expecting Three Pines frustrate you at all because you are your own place?
Oh, not at all. No, we always say Louise Penny's fans are the nicest people in the world, and they all come in and they're just so full of joy and so excited to find what they think is Three Pines, and they always ask us, and we always, our answer is what I hope Louise's answer is it's Three Pines is your utopia, and this is definitely our utopia, being able to run a bookstore with my husband. And we hope that when they come into the store, they find a little bit of their utopia as well. You know, they've come from as far away as Tasmania. We had this couple in from Tasmania last week, and we said, you win. They can't come away from any further.
So. No, I think even if you went the other way around, you wouldn't be any further away.
That's right.
Well, Louise? Danny and Lucy, too, have become real characters themselves, in that I write about them, about my relationship with Danny and Lucy, about the bookstore. But I get emails. I got an email the other day, and I think I forwarded it to you, from some, I can't remember where they're from, somewhere in the States, who described coming here and how much it meant to them, but went out of their way to say that Danny and Lucy were a big part of their feeling of being included and welcomed. And you guys do that. They send out, when you send out mugs to people, you include a licorice pipe as well. And people adore the two of you. You clearly have them fooled.
We had this lovely lady, Arlene from Texas, and she started ordering books about 3 years ago. And we sort of developed this relationship and started writing letters. And she sent us a package from Texas of all these Texas things, like magnets saying, don't mess with Texas, and and things like that. And, we've developed these incredible relationships with people. And there was another lady from Arizona who said, you live in the most beautiful place in the world. And then she sent us a picture of her house, and it had these incredible mountains behind it and this infinity pool, and we're like, you live in an incredible place as well. You know,
we have this other person from Australia who was a nun. I can't remember her name, but she really wanted to have a mug, a Viva Gamash mug. And so, but we sent it surface, and so we started this correspondence with her. You know, is that a arrived yet? No, not quite. And then she'd tell us about the weather and her place and what her town was like. And we talk about our town, and we have these huge long letters back and forth and back and forth for 3 months, because it took 3 months for the poor mug to make it there. But she was thrilled when she finally got it.
There certainly seems to be a lot of love between you and the people who find you and your customers. But, you know, love and affection and handwritten notes don't pay the bills. And there's been a lot of hand-wringing over the last decade about independent booksellers and whether they'll be able to survive. And there was actually a report recently that said the rise of e-readers has not dampened people's ability to want, or their desire to have paper books. But still, it's difficult to be a bookseller. And I would imagine even in a place that draws a lot of tourists, you have to have the support of your local community to survive. Is that something that you feel like you guys have and can continue doing?
Well, we're an independent bookstore in Quebec, and that's actually a very special thing to be, because one of the only English bookstores, independent bookstores in Quebec, and they have a special law here that the schools and libraries have to buy from independent bookstores within the province. And so we're well supported by them, the schools and libraries, and that's sort of our bread and butter, apart from Louise, of course. but then I'm sure also we are incredibly well supported by our community.
I try not to think about it, but, but more—it's more just being part of the community and just loving being here and just letting whatever happens happens. And we're very active in all sorts of parts of the community, and that's what's fun. And I just, you know, let the business be. It's just we're living here.
But for you, Louise, you're, I think, headed to Toronto tomorrow, is that right? Or
Vancouver.
Tonight? Vancouver. And so, you know, you're a huge bestseller. As we've established, you sell all around the world. So why come here to do, I think this is your first launch event, isn't it?
Always. This is the tradition, is it? And I've made it clear to the publishers that this is where we have the world launch of all the books from Rome Lake Books. And do you remember, though, when we first started doing it, it was like, what, five or six people would show up, and then a few more people the next year, and it was just, there was modest events. And then one year, I was trying to remember this morning, it was, what, about 4 or 5 years ago, suddenly, when we had to move it outside, and it was huge.
And because it got so warm in the room, because there were just so many people packed in, and we had to line up out one door. We moved Louise out the other door. So, you know, it just went from...
We didn't expect it.
No, not at all.
No, and then we've since moved it to the community center, and now we're actually looking for someplace else if possible.
Yes. Oh, really?
Yeah, so it's been amazing. And Danny and Lucy supported the books when nobody else knew. Nobody else knew that this series. But every year you'd put on a party, you'd make me feel special. And so, you know, now I'm, of course, going to leave you in the dust. Danny and Lucy, who are they? Speak to the hand. But...
Yeah, I remember actually when Louise first came into the bookstore with your manuscript and for Still Life.
Which was the first in the Gamache series.
Yes, that's correct. And she said, you know, I've just finished this and I want somebody to read it. That was way back when. And then, you know, the excitement of getting published and then bringing in the crisp new books. And it was, you know, so it's been... you know, we've both been with her since the beginning, and that's it's been so exciting, this incredible growth of love around the world.
And it's so fun to give back, for me to give back to a community that has supported me and that knew me years before I started writing, and it's been really, really meaningful.
Okay, so we have to talk a little bit about the book. I was up until 2 a.m. reading it, and so, you know, it's both very fresh, and now I feel, you know, like I am in Three Pines still, and, you know, I'm a little bit nervous because there's always... You have a little bit of the Agatha Christie and British Mystery Series template here in that it's a beautiful... picturesque village, but a lot of people seem to get murdered, or there are a lot of, I think it, what was it, Midsummer Murders in the UK. Midsummer, they did some study that showed up against the real world places where murder rates are highest, Little Midsummer would have the highest rate in the world, and Three Pines is not that far behind at this point. But what can you tell us about The Nature of the Beast as it's coming out now?
Well, The Nature of the Beast is based on a true story, actually, and I can't talk about it because I don't want to spoil anything. But really, like most of the books, they're not really about murder. And this one is clearly a crime novel, clearly a mystery, but it's really more about the power of storytelling, the power of words, the stories that we tell in books, in plays, but the more intimate stories too that we tell each other, the blurred line between fact and fiction. And then the even more intimate stories that we tell ourselves privately that allow us to get out of bed in the morning, that what you're doing isn't such a bad thing, that it's the things that we say to justify our actions and how that affects our actions going forward. So it's really about the power of the word, both written and spoken, and the power of storytelling.
I think, you know, without giving anything away, you could also say it's about ego and power. And when powerful forces collide, but then when one person who believes he or she has the power to change the world, but maybe doesn't have the ethical center behind it to think about whether or not something should be done, which feels very relevant to today. I mean, we're still looking at aggression around the world, and part of the book deals with political aggression and the power of countries to fight or to kill. Are you thinking of, I mean, you're a former CBC journalist, so are you thinking about the aggression in the real world as you bring that aggression right to the heart of Three Pines?
Oh, absolutely. This is rooted in real world events, and that's not something that's completely new to the series. I've tried to do that in many of the books, so that there isn't a complete fantasy element of it. There is a reality about it, and I think people reading it can recognize themselves personally in the books, but also recognize the world around them.
That was Canadian novelist Louise Penny. Her latest book is called The Nature of the Beast. I was talking with her and with Danny McCauley and Lucy Hoblin, the co-owners of Brome Lake Books. Louise Penny has told me before that she loves her job. Not only does she spend her time imagining the goings-on in the lovely little village of Three Pines, but she gets to travel the world to promote her books, and she advocates for Alzheimer's awareness. So her job is pretty great, but what makes any job fabulous or dreadful? Tomorrow on this program, we'll discuss good and bad jobs and how to find the right one for you. So we want to hear about your best and worst jobs. Email your stories to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and listen to the program tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.